All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And now I'm happy to tell you that Tom Woods is on the line. Thomas E. Woods, Jr., that is. TomWoods.com is the website. He's a fellow, perhaps a senior fellow or something like that, at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, where the Austrian economists gather. That's Mises.org. And he is a historian who, and a lot of other things too, but an author of a great many books, How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization, 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask, and We Who Dared Say No to War is co-edited by Tom Woods, History of American anti-war activism from 1812 to current, the church and the market, more and more, and then also a lot of libertarian activist stuff, nullification, meltdown, a free market look at why the economic crisis is all the government's fault, and rollback, repealing big government before the coming fiscal collapse, the one that hasn't happened yet even. Whew. Welcome back to the show, Tom. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me.
I know you're a hardcore Ron Paulian, always out there beating the bushes for new supporters for his campaign for the presidency, which makes me very grateful to you that you do so much along those lines. But I want to talk with you about the Ron Paul campaign right now, but I kind of want to, if it's okay, put you in your role as a historian and really talk not so much about Dr. Paul himself necessarily as much as the revolution, as it's called, as it's been called since 2007, and kind of what that means in the history of American politics for what I like to think is this realignment that's actually occurring, sort of like everybody except the very few classical liberals all came together for the New Deal consensus and that big realignment in the 1930s. Maybe we have a new realignment, well, kind of against that very thing going on right now. What do you think?
Well, you know, the history that's relevant would be the history since the late 19th century when we started to get this. Because to me, the key part of the Ron Paul message is the foreign policy aspect. I mean, I guess also the Federal Reserve is a major plank, but those things are related, I think, too. But the foreign policy is the one that I think really you separate the sheep from the goats or whatever that expression is, because I think there are a lot of right-wingers who would be willing to accept his views on the Fed and just sort of take them as, you know, kind of oddball and we'll accept this if that's what's necessary to get the rest of this guy's package, but it's the foreign policy that is the stumbling block for them. So I focused on that as his main message. So the history that's relevant would be the history of the U.S. since maybe 1898, where there was a more aggressive overseas presence, and whether it was justified on Wilsonian, humanitarian, internationalist grounds, or Teddy Rooseveltian, nationalist, realist ground, it doesn't really matter. The outcome is always the same. It's always more intervention. When have we really seen any type of, even by an outraged minority, serious pushback against this in U.S. history? And it's pretty rare. I mean, after World War I, there was definitely a disillusionment with Woodrow Wilson that crept in. That didn't last too long because then there was World War II. And then maybe during the Cold War, Vietnam did sour some people on the Empire Project. But still, in terms of a slice of the public that was willing to question all the premises behind the reigning foreign policy, very, very few. Whereas now you have a situation where, again, not nearly a majority of the public, it's true, it would be very hard to get a majority of the public out of being plugged into the propaganda news networks, out of feeling like, hey, it's awesome to be an American because we got more divisions than you have and we can blow you to smithereens, and that makes, even though I'm a loser, I feel better as a human being because I know that. It's hard to compete with that. I realize that you're dealing with the basest human emotions. But still, you've got, I mean, it would have to be in the millions now of people who aren't just saying, this war or that war was strategically ill-conceived or is costing us too much money or whatever. They're saying the whole thing is based on lies and profiteering and wickedness, and it's immoral, and it makes no sense even on its own terms, and we'd be much better off without it. I mean, I don't think, especially a youth movement like this, I don't know that there is a real precedent for that.
Yeah, well, certainly it doesn't seem like... well, here's the thing that jumps out about it all to me, is that even though really, Dr. Paul, if you had to classify him, I think, in political terms somewhere, he's maybe Anthony Gregory would call him a paleo-liberal, or, you know, he's a real classical liberal of the old definition. But he, at the same time, he's such a square, you know, in his personal life and whatever, he fits that role of that very conservative. And in a way, he is extremely conservative in that he's trying to conserve the Enlightenment era, what's left of it from the revolutionary time in American history. But he kind of, as a Texas Republican, genial, old doctor and that kind of thing, he gives a permission slip, it seems like to me, for people who thought that if you love America, you have to go along with whatever foreign policy, because that's always what they've heard their whole life, where here's this guy is a conservative old Texas Republican saying, you don't have to be, you know, identify with the politics of Janine Garofalo and the Film Actors Guild or whatever in order to oppose these crazy foreign policies. And like you said, he puts it all out on the table. Oh, no, the whole thing is completely corrupt, and it's all based on profiteering and lies, and it's, you know, all this, you know, he's very frank about all of this stuff. The kind of, he uses the kind of language that's never allowed in that level of political discussion in this country, and he really is changing a lot, it seems. I was reading an article today about just the damn near riot going on when he gives a speech. They're so excited to hear someone that honest who actually has a shot at being able to get up there and veto some things.
Yeah, of course you're right. Now, I think, as I say, historically it's hard to really find a parallel to him, particularly because when you do look at anti-war movements, they are sort of viewed as being countercultural and people who are a little offbeat tend to be associated with them. So it tends to push off the bourgeois mainstream. That feel, you know, the soccer moms and the minivans feel uncomfortable with that crowd. But, hey, you know, we're a big tent now. It's great.
It's amazing, and you know, it's so fun to watch him give a speech, and where they're just interrupting him, going, they're just going, shut up, old man, we want to chant end the Fed for a while, and he's just giggling up there. He just doesn't know what to do. So I've been in the audience when there was 20 of us in the audience listening to Ron Paul talk, and it's just great seeing him up there just rocking every TV on earth. All right, we'll be right back. TomWoods.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Tom Woods, TomWoods.com, Mises.org. He's the author of Roll Back, Repealing Big Government Before the Coming Fiscal Collapse. And he's a historian, author of a great many books. And we're talking about the Ron Paul campaign and, you know, what it means. It's, to me, well, and Tom, I think you and I, long before Ron even ran, in 2007, we talked on this show about the realignment where the people on the left and the right and among libertarians who have their priorities straight in opposing really the very worst things going on, and that is, of course, the empire and the destruction of the Bill of Rights along with our economy, that we can all realign and focus on stopping these horrible policies. And here, just right in time, really before it's too late, I hope, like Roll Back, the title of your book, repealing this thing before it all falls apart the hard way. Here he comes, waltzing right in. We have the perfect opportunity. And, you know, it seems like a pretty, you know, like later on, this will be a really cool chapter in American history, no matter how it works out, that, you know, either we get it done right, and it's really cool, just like it should be, or it's another one of those where you go, oh, man, and then America joined World War One with the rest of them or whatever.
Yeah, I know,
exactly. It's one of those that you wish you could take back evermore for getting it wrong. Anyway, I just wonder what you think about all that, the realignment, whether some of this is going to stick. I know it's hard to get Democrats to change parties and vote in a caucus or something like that when it comes to the electoral thing, but I'm thinking more in terms of the ideas and the later on.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. It would be nice to see once in a while when I get a hostile progressive. I did a YouTube called War is Better Than Ron Paul, Say Some Progressives. And basically my theme is, well, whenever somebody, let's say, posts on my Facebook, I have a Facebook so-called fan page, and once in a while a hostile progressive will post there and say, I can't support that nutcase Ron Paul, why he favors blah, 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 listing all these things that the president has no authority over anyway. And so I always write in the reply, I say, let me translate your comment. Your comment translated into real English is, I'm sorry, people of Iran, but I'm afraid you will just have to be killed because I can't bring myself to support the one person who won't bomb you to smithereens because he doesn't match my views on this, 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 and this, none of which would obviously change under him as president anyway, but I'm too self-centered to realize that. I mean, that's basically what you're doing. You're sending a letter to the people of Iran saying, I'm so sorry, but my progressive sensibilities are such that you're just going to have to be killed, because that's less important to me than satisfying and making myself feel good about myself.
Which
about
makes them the perfect counterparts to the conservatives who say, who at least pretend that they agree with them on drastically cutting back everything.
Right.
Except that their thirst for the blood of innocence just cannot be turned over to this guy and his, you know, they see him as some sort of a weakling, I guess, because he wants to relent on the killing for a second, I suppose.
Now, that reminds me of a second point that I want to make. Again, thinking about historically, we think about foreign policy and American opinion and what Americans have thought about the various wars they've participated in. And what's interesting to note is that you do see in the past some opposition to war that isn't entirely based on, hey, this is too expensive, or we should have been bombing this other group of people instead of that one. So one of the first example, actually, in U.S. history of there being a kind of a coalition between people of unlike minds, progressives and old-time conservatives, was, as you know, the Anti-Imperialist League at the end of the 19th century fighting against imperialism in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't just say, oh, this is undesirable because it's going to make our republic into an empire, which is a good argument, that's good enough. But they went on and chronicled all the atrocities that were taking place, the fact that Teddy Roosevelt was pretty much looking the other way at these things, that this was horrendously bloody. So it's nice to see that we are part of it, but that never really became a mass movement. I mean, that was it had a decent number of members, but not anything like the Ron Paul movement. But to see this many people who are moved not just by the strategic arguments that obviously we need to retrench from overseas to avoid going bankrupt. That should be obvious to anyone at all. But also to see people who look overseas and see fellow human beings suffering. And they don't get caught up in the flag and the Sean Hannity propaganda, but they just look at other human beings. Some of them are people of no religious faith. And yet they are more likely to look upon the humanity of other human beings than many of the self-proclaimed Christians who advocate these policies. And this to me is one of the great things about this movement, is that it's not entirely just based on self-centeredness and America this and America that. It really is about, I mean, when the word love is in revolution spelled backwards, that's not just some little bit of agitprop. Like, that's something real. This is really based on the idea that there are certain things, there's certain ways human beings ought to treat each other. There are ways we ought to treat each other here in the U.S., and there are ways that we ought to treat people around the world, and it's the same way. If there's a single law that binds everybody, and this has become this radical, crazy idea, but suddenly it's become kind of fashionable.
Yeah, it's like Daphne Evietar, human rights first.
Yeah.
I mean, what's so hard to understand about that, man?
I know. But, I mean, you just, there's just this constant fight. And here's
it's going to be fun, though, too. Let me be evil here for a second and just point out that after they're done giving it to Mitt Romney or Rick Santorum or whichever other devil, it's going to be fun in an ironical kind of way that they had their chance again and the American people told him no again. The one guy who was going to bring the empire home, the one guy who was going to, you know, submit to the Congress the 2013 version of the 2007 Freedom Restoration Act that repealed 15 horrible Bill of Rights shredding laws immediately and all that kind of thing, that they told him no again. Peace and liberty and a sound economy on a silver platter, and they told him no again. Thomas Jefferson resurrected, only without all the compromising slavery issues and embargoes against British goods, and running for president, and they're telling him no again. And they have two chances even, and they say no. They prefer, what, Newt Gingrich? I don't know, Tom.
I've said the same thing.
It's fun in a certain sort of suicidal kind of way.
Well, people who go to TomWoods.com who haven't seen it yet should type into the search box 26 things. It's my most viewed post in the history of the site. 26 things non-Paul voters are basically saying. And it, when you really spell it out, it is, as you say, Scott, pretty harrowing that people would be this dense, basically. Now, let me add, though, that I think there is a colossal mistake being made, and I was warning about this from the get-go. I think the campaign thought that the best thing to do would be to, you know, look, Ron's got this foreign policy, and there's nothing we can do about it. So we'll just try not to talk about it the best we can, and we'll just go from there. Now, I can understand them saying something like, we have to pitch it in a way that's going to be palatable to primary voters. So I'm okay with that, as long as you're not compromising. But not to mention it at all, which is, I mean, you don't see it in any of the ads. No official communications talk about it. It's just nothing. So there's been no attempt to defend it, no attempt to get panels of foreign policy experts who agree with him, just anything. Just make the case. There is a great case to be made for his foreign policy. And
yeah, you would think his own campaign would have noticed his leadership qualities. And, you know, anytime anybody says, hey, what do you think about, you know, things? He goes, well, you know, I really would like to end the wars. And go ahead and let him talk. And he'll talk about the wars all the time. He'll put foreign policy first all the time. USA Today said, hey, if you were to tone it down a bit more, you'd probably could win this thing. And so why don't you do that? And he said, that's the last thing I'm going to do. I want to win, but I want to win because I get everybody to agree with me about these wars. We have to end these wars. We have to be right about ending these wars. I mean, man. Yeah, I don't know. Campaign people, I don't know. What are you going to do?
The fact that this guy would go into Florida and say, we got to open up trade with Cuba again fully. Who else does that? And I don't care if you think the embargo on Cuba is the greatest policy in the history of the world. You should have voted for him just for the guts that it took to do that instead of just sitting there flattering you.
Yeah. Well, I think America is going to be better off for this thing. I hope the Republican Party doesn't end up better off for this. But I'm very grateful for him for what he's done and all the people exposed to the libertarian idea by him. It's just incredible.
Yeah, and that's why he looks happy every time we see him.
Yeah, it's true. It really is. And you know what? And I don't know if you're talking to people on the campaign or what, but they're talking in the chat room here, and they're making a great point that they're not seeing a lot of town hall type events. And from what I know from last time and this time too, one glance at RonPaulFlix.com will, I think, prove that Ron Paul is great in the town hall things. The only problem is if the guy with the microphone is way in the back and the sound system isn't so good and he can't quite hear the question right or whatever, but that can be solved pretty easily by just having people come up to the front or whatever, have a little bit better interaction. But there's been some of these things, especially in New Hampshire, where he just is batting 1,000 up there because he has time to not give his TV answer, but to really explain to them, you know, what he really thinks about stuff. And you can just see him being converted, you know, on live studio audience by the dozens and dozens as their heads start to nod that they're really finally starting to understand what this guy's about and they like it. You know? He's great.
I'd like to see more of that, too, because that would help on the foreign policy front.
Yeah, and, you know, if you clicked, actually, you'd have to go back a few pages on Ron Paul Flicks, and you can see some really great ones back, especially coming up before New Hampshire and a few in Iowa. Anyway, I don't really want to talk about the electoral politics stuff anymore because it doesn't matter. And really, we're over time. So I'll let you go. But I'll thank you very much for your time on the show today, Tom.
As always, a pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Everybody, check out Tom Woods' website, tomwoods.com, and especially tomwoods.com/books for Rollback, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, Nullification, How to Resist Federal Tyranny in the 21st Century, and this one I think is really important for your understanding about how the world works, because he really understands well and writes it very well in this very important book, Meltdown, A Free Market Look at Why the Stock Market Collapsed, the Economy Tanked, and Government Bailouts Will Make Things Worse. It came out in, what, like January 09 or whatever, right at the dawn of the financial crisis, explaining what's really going on here, and I think you would benefit from it immensely. And also, of course, on point, We Who Dared Say No to War, co-edited with Murray Polner, anti-American anti-war writing from 1812 to now.